You know that whole glass half empty, glass half full trope? I feel like it doesn't really work that great for me. And I mean, I feel like I get it. You know, that whole optimist, pessimist, half full, half empty, good news, bad news. You know, it's all going to hell in a handbasket. It's all good. These sorts of binaries, these sorts of either ors, they're simple. And like lots of simplifications, they can be clarifying. It's very convenient for us to say that's good, that's bad, and kind of make it that, you know, that straightforward. But in the end, those ways of thinking and speaking about our life experiences are not a very good representation of how we actually experience the world. They're too either or, and the world is too both and. So there's an either or about both and. And but anyway, that kind of bugs me, that trope. Glass half empty, glass half full. That part of its character kind of bugs me. But another thing that bugs me is that I don't have anything equally tidy or sort of meme-worthy to replace it with. I don't feel like I have a bumper sticker, you know, that would sum up something like the world is complicated, the level in the glass isn't static, and depending on what angle I'm looking at it from, the same stuff can look like good news or bad news, or news whose goodness or badness remains to be seen, or that includes both, or that is something in between. How do you turn that into glass half full, glass half empty, right? How do you kind of compress that into a sentence like that? And honestly, sometimes, you know, when it comes to how things look, whether they look good or bad or in between, sometimes we just don't even want to look. One of our kids, I was having a conversation with them about a variety of things, and they were telling me a story about being with a friend recently, and they were, of course, talking with this friend about current events, and he said that eventually the conversation made them both feel so overwhelmed and anxious that they agreed to just stop talking about it and, you know, watch something on Netflix. And I think at some level or other, most of us can relate to that. We touched on it this morning with what Sarah shared in the community time and Zach's response to that, right? The uncertainty, the how's this going to go? Man, that can be very wearisome. We can get to this place where we feel something like, I not only can't tell if the glass is half empty or half full, but I am just weary of looking at it and trying to tell. Well, this morning, I want to try for something that is both and. I want to both acknowledge that experience and its validity, and I want to explore one way of looking at the glass that might help equip us to hold a more complex view of things, one that can sort of bolster our ability to name and look right at the hard things, but also foster some sense of hope in the midst of that process. And the key to this morning's exploration is a word. And if you read the blurb, this is the word for which I launched that, you know, winner takes all contest for the Timbits. There were a couple of creative responses, I'm pleased to say. Including one that you can see on the Facebook page. Judy, I'm sure beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but oh my goodness, where did you ever find a picture like that? Whatever that creature is, to my eyes, it lacks beauty. But it's a very good illustration of a stretched neck. And the other response I got was an intriguing spelling of giraffe, a gyroph from Ray, who of course would be, you know, our most regular supplier of the Timbits and would get them anyway. So I'm not really sure. Maybe it just means I get the Timbits, but nobody hit the word that I was thinking of, which I didn't really expect. It was a very oblique setup for the contest. But the word that this all hinges on is the word apocalypse. Now, that's a word with an interesting history. Much of its history is bound up in our Western sort of North American experience of that word and its usage. Much of its history is bound up with the history of religion, and in particular with the history of the Christian religion, and we'll kind of get to some of that in a moment. Apocalypse was the original name for what we would now typically call the Book of Revelation, which is a Jewish writing that, for those that are not aware, forms the last segment of most Christian Bibles. And the book itself is characterized by some interesting things. I'm not going to be exploring the book of Revelation this morning for those of you that have read it or heard people preach from it or, you know, whatever, those kind of things. Do be calm. We're not going there. But it does sort of set up some other ideas. So the original name for the book of Revelation was Apocalypse, the book of Apocalypse. And that book is characterized by some interesting features, one of which is pseudonymity, not a word most of us use in everyday conversation. Pseudonymity was this interesting convention that took place during the period between the Old Testament and the New Testament. There's a big gap in there chronologically. And in that period, one of the things that happened is that people who were trying to present certain writings as sort of as scripture or canon or kind of holy text, sacred text, one of the things they would do is they would take certain books and they would present them as being written by someone well known, so written by Moses or like Enoch or the sons of Jacob was a common one, even though there was no, they weren't written by those people. So they would give them a pseudonymic author. And they did that to give the book more credibility in its context. One of the things that's interesting is that it was known that this was being done. It was a fairly common practice. It was not condemned as deceitful. Although you could step over the line and attribute the wrong book to the wrong person and get fired. That happened in the first century as well. But it was sort of this first century version of alternative facts, in some ways. The book is also full of symbolic imagery. And it contains, and I did not make this next sentence up myself, I lifted it straight from the Oxford Bible Dictionary. It contains the expectation of an imminent cosmic cataclysm. I told you I didn't write it. Imminent cosmic cataclysm in which God destroys the ruling powers of evil and raises the righteous to life in a messianic kingdom. So there you go, Oxford Bible Dictionary for a summary of the book of Revelation, formerly known as the Book of Apocalypse. Now, that kind of information could matter to different people for quite a different range of reasons these days. If you choose to read a book like the Book of Revelation literally instead of literarily, it might matter to you because you think of yourself as one of the people that ends up being counted as righteous and as part of that idea of a messianic kingdom. Or to put it in sort of more direct terms, when God destroys the earth, you might think of yourself as one of the people that gets saved. There are people who, of course, view the whole story that way. That information might matter to you if you choose to read a book like that as a kind of foretelling of the future, in which the sort of bear imagery, the furry kind of bear, there's lots of this in Revelation, in which the bear imagery in the book means Russia or some other sort of current enemy of the West. So maybe this week that would be China. I don't know. The locusts are helicopters, and so this is all about end times military action. So if you read it that way, that stuff might matter. I have a vague memory, a childhood memory of there being a comic book in our house, sort of religious comic book that was all about this particular kind of reading of the book of Revelation. I can gratefully report that that perspective wasn't one I grew up soaking in, which I think that'd be a hard one to process as an adult. But to this day, whenever I encounter a prophet of doom, somebody who's wearing the sandwich board that says, repent, the end is coming, there's this little niggle in my head that's kind of like, did that guy, it's usually a guy, did that guy find that comic book and just like believe it wholesale? Like, is that how he got there? I'm not sure. In the context of what we're exploring this morning, that kind of information might matter because the images in the book and the themes of imminent cosmic cataclysm fueled by the wrath of God have become deeply interwoven with the ways we still tend to use the word apocalypse in our culture these days. And that's true to no small degree, whether we grew up, as Sarah just mentioned in her post, whether we grew up being exposed to that kind of teaching about what the book meant or not, that general understanding has kind of made its way into our culture. Now, I can't demonstrate this as a fact. Maybe someone wants to do the research. But my strong suspicion, Tim, this could be your next doctorate. But my strong suspicion is that that the caused by God part of that definition, while it's sort of still rattling around in our use of the word, it's kind of receding as our collective cultural attenuation to a relatively uniform understanding of an idea like God sort of also recedes. But the idea of imminent cosmic cataclysm feels like it's alive and well. So when we use a word like apocalypse, that idea still feels like it's pretty resonant. Small illustration, these days the Plett household has been watching The Umbrella Academy, second season. We have watched the first season already, and we just kept going. If you know how it ends, don't say anything. Please don't comment. I don't want to know. I want to have the experience for myself. But all to say, one of the main features of that Netflix production is that one of the things that drives various plot lines in the show is this idea of the pending destruction of the Earth, repeatedly referred to as the apocalypse. And the imagery is more or less what you would expect. It's fiery destruction, usually from the sky, blowing up and burning up all the things that we humans have made or enjoy. That's just one very small illustration. But that language and imagery, when we use a word like apocalypse, that's fairly pervasive. That's fairly common. So it's really no surprise, I don't think, that when things go sideways in a manner that threatens not only our way of life, but our sense of a predictable future existence, the way we might feel about COVID, for example, that the fears or the language of apocalypse show up as well. But here's an important thing about language and imagery. The words and pictures that we are constantly exposed to, perhaps in quite insistent ways, are the ones that we tend to carry around in our imaginations. They're the ones that get sort of called up by association. So when the language of apocalypse is used, the images that have been associated with it are the ones that tend to just sort of pop right up in our thinking. And that's pretty powerful stuff. That image is still rooted, for most of us, in the idea of destruction from somewhere cosmic. And it sort of shows up a lot. Something that feels like it came like, quote, you know, a bolt from the blue. If you don't see Zeus at the other end of that bolt, then you should maybe give that a little more thought, right? Where did that destructive bolt come from? Maybe we could call that the glass half empty way of understanding the language of apocalypse. Now, if we feel like we want a glass half full version, we've got some options. And I'm going to really oversimplify here for the sake of illustration. And I'll use the current pandemic to represent apocalypse. All right. So if we want a glass half full version of that, we've got the fairly common sort of science light version. That's LIT light, which is the idea that we're just hanging on for a vaccine, at which point everything goes back to normal. So maybe that's a kind of glass half full-ish version. We've got the self-help guru version, which might camp out on it's all in how you look at it. So start looking at it as all good, and that's how it's going to be. You know, sort of the power of positive thinking would have been a phrase from my 20s that's in that same camp. We've got the religious version, which in my experience might be summed up as something like we messed up, glass half empty. God came and fixed it, glass half full. And if we believe the right things, God will get us out of this mess either now or later. Glass all full, all good, except for the poor folks that got it wrong for whom the glass is now completely empty. So a little bit complicated. Remember, in the context of this exploration this morning, these are all ways of looking at or responding to the idea of apocalypse as most commonly presented to us as an imminent cosmic cataclysm. All right? However, as is often the case, there is another way to think about that same language and imagery that's considerably older, more historically established than the one offered by these sort of various takes on the Book of Revelation or the potent images of filmmakers. And I also want to suggest that it's potentially more helpful, at least if we're interested or willing to carry a more complex view of the world and its events. This is kind of amusing to me as a word nerd. The ancient Greek word for apocalypse is, you know, refreshingly, basically apocalypse. That one didn't morph all that much. It comes from two words, the ancient Greek word apo and the word kalupto. Apo means away or from or after. Kalupto means to cover or to conceal. So the original Greek word apocalypse means to uncover or to reveal or to lay bare. If you look it up in a contemporary dictionary instead of in a Greek lexicon, you'll find that the word literally means an uncovering, a disclosure or a revelation of knowledge. That's what the word apocalypse means. Hence the name swap for revelation, right? This is a book of the revealing of certain things, is the idea. So that sense of referring to some kind of significant upheaval is still there in that definition, but the focus is on what is revealed by the upheaval, not on the upheaval itself. And it kind of carried in the ancient Greek, the word carried with it this sense of stretching your neck to see something, trying to see over the upheaval, if you will, to what was revealed by it. And that's where the subtitle in my notes, "What Stretched Your Neck," came from, right? Not from strange creatures in the bottom of the ocean, or giraffes spelled funny or whatever. I'm not sure. I'm still not sure exactly what Ray was after with his word, but it made me laugh. So that idea, though, one translation of the Greek word apocalypse would be to watch with outstretched head, right? So to kind of be straining, doing the work of seeing beyond the upheaval, not to ignore it or be in denial about it, but to learn from it, to see what is being revealed by it. So if we think about that in colloquial terms, we could say that the word also gestures toward the passing of an era, toward a sea change, toward once you've seen it, you can't unsee it kind of human experience. So in many ways, we could consider the word apocalypse as an invitation. I hope that there's been a process leading to that idea. Otherwise, it could just feel like nice denial, Tim, you know, nice glass half full self-help guru take on this. I think it's a little more complex than that. I think it's an invitation to see, to look at what is happening around us and to ask ourselves, so not in denial of what's happening around us, but to look right at it, to look at it as squarely as we can, and then to ask ourselves, what does this reveal? What does this uncover? And it's worth noting that although many things might be revealed that we don't want to see or that we don't want to look at, or that might be difficult for us to see, things may also be revealed that are reasons for hope. And it's important that we don't unsee those because their context is difficult or tragic or alarming, all things that are true about this pandemic. In fact, it's for all those reasons that the events that might cause us to stretch to see what's being revealed are difficult or tragic or alarming. For all those reasons, we need to work hard to keep the hopeful revelations, that apocalyptic view that says something is being revealed here we need to learn from or can learn from and that stirs hope. We need to keep those pieces together. We need to keep doing both. Now, that's the kind of work that no one can do for us. That's work we can only do for ourselves, but we can help one another. And so I'm going to leave us with a couple of examples of what I'm trying to poke at this morning. They're illustrative. They're not exhaustive. They really might not be the ones that resonate for you. I would say that in my experience, part of what is being uncovered in this apocalypse is that we as a species have a remarkable capacity for change. Now, we might not always want to change. Maybe we almost never want to change, and we might not choose to change, but it's not because we're not capable. And I think that's important. The capacity for change, for making behavioral changes globally on a massive scale, is clearly part of our story. We can learn new language. Did you use the phrase social distancing or physical distancing as part of vernacular, 6 months ago? I didn't. We can learn new ideas. We can learn new behaviors. One of my favorite illustrations, because of my sometimes contact with the university world, is, that universities have been talking for 20 years about going online and how important it is and how much it needs to be done. And with very few exceptions, didn't do it because it was just too hard. It would cost too much. It would take too long. We'd have to learn too many new things. And then when we had to, we did it in 2 weeks. And yes, it was hard. And yes, we had to learn some things. And yes, we're still learning things. I can tell you some very funny, aging professorial, I don't really want to learn those stories. But we can, and we did, and we will. And that's important. So that's a small illustration, a small scale illustration. I mean, we've talked about how telecommuting more people would be good for the planet, and then we sent millions of people to work from home in a matter of days. So we can choose to change our behavior if we choose to change our behavior. Now, I think it's easy for us to lose sight of that hopeful idea that is being revealed by this apocalypse because we are being bombarded by bad news stories or stories of people that are not willing to work together to be part of the solution. Why would I give my attention? Why would I give my energy to a story about a couple of hundred people that are protesting, being asked to stay at home or to not gather, when at the very same time, millions, billions of people are doing it and doing it well and making it work? It's a choice, right? The vast majority of the people that I know and that I encounter that I don't know are working hard to care for one another, to protect one another, to make the changes that are necessary. We can change. And I think that's very hopeful information. I was driving through a neighborhood near ours the other day to pick up the mail, and some youngster, a school-age kid, was celebrating a birthday, right? So big sandwich board, homemade bristle board sign on the curb. Everybody was out on the lawn, like honk. It's Jacob's birthday or whatever the child's name was. I was right across the street picking up the mail. I honked. I rolled down the window to say happy birthday. We had a whole conversation, the birthday boy and I, which was quite delightful. Parents sitting in the background, sort of appreciating the whole thing and feeling good about it. I don't know that kid, and I won't probably get to know that kid, but I sure, for sure, wouldn't have been part of celebrating their birthday without these changes. And so, a little gift, right? In the middle of this, boy, that's awkward. We can't do what we had planned to do. We can't have all your school friends over. And we could make a long list of things we couldn't do, but we could do this. And it was good. And that's a reason for hope. I think we need to hold that stuff. We need to talk about it. We need to celebrate it. We need to keep it in front of us because, the people who are selling the news are not going to keep those stories in front of us necessarily. I see that Sarah has posted an alternative news site here that focuses on good news. Thank you, Sarah. There are others like that, of course. There are people who have this sort of same idea and who are like, I'm going to do that. Think it's worth remembering that when we make those kinds of changes in whatever realm, including the realm of what we believe, which is what we're exploring here, we don't necessarily make them because, it's all good, because the glass feels half full to us. We do those things in the midst of suffering and uncertainty and upheaval. We're doing it collectively in many instances in this COVID circumstance. We're doing it even when we don't all agree about the parameters or the nature of the problem. And that's kind of remarkable. We can change. I feel like that's hopeful. Another thing that I've noticed is that we're making new rituals. I don't know how much you think about ritual. It's a relatively new realm for me to kind of have running in the background of my cultural radar when I'm looking around, to be looking for rituals and thinking about the things that I do and that we do as rituals. In our house, for example, one of the rituals that we kind of instituted relatively early on, and this was the ritual of an online Zoom Saturday brunch with family members that are distant. And honestly, aside from the fact that, Mom, if you're watching, you can blush if you want, but I'm just super proud of my mom for learning how to use Zoom, and showing up for these things. And other people, right? I mean, so we figured it out, We used the tools we had and we figured out this new ritual, this new way to gather with people. Rituals categorically do a really important thing. They awaken us to the possibility that if we could experience something like this in this moment, so if we could experience a sense of connectivity, for example, in this Zoom breakfast or this Zoom brunch, we could have that same experience somewhere else. Right? It's portable. We could create a ritual somewhere else, or we could take what we're experiencing in this ritual, that feeling of connection, for example, and we could have that experience in other places. I usually try to be not too distracted by the comments that pop up on my screen during the live feed and just stay focused on my notes so this doesn't expand, and take hours. But Justin just asked, so is the apocalypse happening now? By the definition I'm using today, Justin, yes. Yes, it is. We are in the midst of an apocalypse. I think it's interesting, and this may not have been deliberate on Justin's part, but the way you phrased the question was, so is the apocalypse happening now? In the ancient Greek understanding of the word, apocalypse was not an event. It was a perspective on events. And so you can have an apocalyptic view of things rather than being caught up in the last event of human history, which is the way we tend to use the word. And I'm just saying, let's not use that word that way. Let's use that word as a way of thinking about the events we're experiencing, COVID. So rather than thinking about them as a cosmic cataclysm in which the world ends and God takes the good people and everybody else, doesn't go to the party, but they get burned in the basement, don't think about it that way. Think about it as a way to look at things that are causing upheaval to see what they reveal. So by that definition, Justin, yes, we are in the midst of an apocalypse. There we go. Back to where we were. So this making of new rituals, that's another way to talk or think about things that happen in what the Hebrew writers would have called our heart, which was a Hebrew word for the self, right? There are things that can happen inside of us that can ripple out into other circumstances in our lives. So Jesus, for example, in Matthew's Gospel in chapter 15, says that out of the heart come the issues of life. That's an interesting phrase. And when I'm talking with people, they say things like, when this is over, we don't really know what that means, but when this is over, I don't want to go back to the way it was before. That there are things that have been revealed here that I want to retain. There are new rituals. There's a going for a walk with a friend or somebody from my household rather than, just sending a text. There's making the time to get together. There's things like that virtual brunch that I was talking about. There's ways of connecting. We can make them a regular part of our lives and stay more connected to the people in our lives. These are all, I would say, ideas we could talk about by saying something has shifted in my heart and it's powerful, and I want to retain that shift, and I want to experience it in other places in my life as well, even if the circumstances become more like they were before. And one of the ways we can do that is by sharing those things that shift in our heart with one another, which is partly why I feel like I'm really grateful for our community. Because it provides an opportunity for us to speak with more freedom than we might have in some other communities of this sort of general kind, about things that are shifting in our heart, about new rituals, about new ideas, about new experiences, and how could we have them in other places and in other ways. If we start to share these things with one another, one of the things that we know can happen is that we can sort of start to build up more momentum around the things that give us hope, the things that stir that. What can I learn from this perspective on everything, including what we believe, including our spirituality and our faith and all those things? I remember having a thought sort of like this cross my mind as well when, for example, the canals in Venice started to clear up because the boats weren't churning up the silt, and we got to see that whales were returning to those waterways. I had a similar feeling when people started posting pictures of the way the pollution started to clear above major population centers when we stopped driving so much. By way of illustrating the complexity of this, I don't know if very many of us would say it's good news that we don't have a job to drive to, right? That does not feel like good news. But many of us might say what happened when we stopped driving so much was good, right? And so how do we find a way to live into the things about this apocalyptic season that bring hope to us and to recreate them in other settings, to make rituals, to make repeat behaviors of them, so that we can keep the thing that stirred hope about that, not just keep it alive, but help it to grow by sharing it with one another. What do experiences like that reveal? Well, maybe one of the things that they reveal is that we have reason to be hopeful about even something as sort of hard to grasp as the future of the planet, or our human ability to change our behavior in ways that could reduce our impact here. Maybe we need to seriously reconsider much of what we think of as normal, much of what we would tend to act on without examining it. And of course, a season like this reveals things that, if they're not revealed as a result of the pandemic, then they're revealed in the context of it. And they might be things that are difficult to look at, but they're important to see. One of the things that comes to mind for me is this groundswell of support for the Black Lives Matter movement, or in general for the dismantling of systemic racism of all kinds. Cohen's line, you know, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in, comes to mind. And when it does in the context of this, I think of that the crack is the apocalyptic events. It's the upheaval, right? The light is that upheaval reveals systemic problems. Now, I'm not saying that the response to Black Lives Matter is hand in glove with COVID as in terms of cause and effect. It's more like context and effect. I think the systemic cracks have been there forever. But I do believe that part of the reason for the groundswell of response is not just a spate of tragedies captured on cell phones, as critical as that is and important as that is to the process, but also the generic shared stress of the moment, the upheaval of the moment. We are already in upheaval. One of the things that can result from that is that we're open to other kinds of change that we wouldn't go looking for if we were just doing our dead level best to keep the ship flat and level and normal and calm, you know? If we're already getting tossed around, there's a way in which sometimes that can open our minds and our hearts and our lives to other kinds of change. Which is why sometimes, for example, spiritual shifts or belief shifts happen when our lives are already in upheaval. We don't get to kind of shortcut to, oh, I know how this all works, because it's not working. And so we have to reconsider, why is that? What does that reveal about what I believed before, for example? I want to live in a world where people take care of one another, not hurt one another. I want to live in a world where we continue to grow in our capacity to choose ways to live that do not depend on the subjugation of the vulnerable. I heard somebody say recently that no one in business makes $1 billion. You take $1 billion. And then they went on to illustrate how much wage slavery it takes for that level of profitability to exist. And that was their perspective on that issue generally. That's interesting, right? And sometimes experiences like the one we're in reveal those kind of cracks in a new or acute or fresh way that can stir us up in our reconsideration of what we believe and how we act. That needs to happen. That it would be happening is a reason for hope, even if what causes it to happen is us stretching to try to see beyond the upheaval. These are the sorts of things that I think if we don't just duck and run for cover, but we're willing to stand up, we're willing to stretch our necks, as it were, to see over the dust that's caused by the headlines, these are the kind of things that can change our hearts and they can change the shape of our lives, personally and all around the world, in ways that could carry the hope we feel in the best moments into the push and shove of the worst ones. And I think that's important. I think these are the kind of things that can change our hearts, they can change ourselves, and from our changed hearts and selves can come changed practices and changed lives and a better world. And to me, that feels like hope in the middle of apocalypse. Not just in the middle of apocalypse or despite apocalypse, but also hope caused by or revealed by apocalypse. There you go. In the end, you know, that's the kind of idea that if it's resonant can be powerful, and if it pushes you away can feel like nonsense. And I realize I'm kind of doing either or with that. And again, there's all this complexity in the middle. But I want to encourage us as individuals and as a community to do what we can to make some effort from that perspective to see not just the distressing events, but to see what they might be revealing and what sort of change that might lead to in us, around us, and between us. I feel hopeful about that. I hope you can too.